outside of the lines of incarceration in some ways. It's not what you would expect. It's felt more like an outward bound experience. It felt more like something, you know, these women are providing a service for the state.
And have any of the women, have any of the prisoners who are fighting the fires lost their lives?
Yes. So that's how I was first sort of not introduced, but that's what why I wanted to write about the program. I had never fully heard of it. And I read a small article about Shauna Lynn Jones, who passed away in February of 2016. And she was on one of the crews in the Malibu camp. There are three female camps. And it struck me that nobody really talked about who she was, how she got there, her background, and how she ended up dead.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion, have you back on later in the week. This is a critical story. Jamie Lowe of New York Times will link to the incarcerated women who fight California's wildfires, has a new book out this week called Mental, and we'll interview you about that. Juan, you're going to be speaking at Rutgers tonight?
Yes, at the Barnes & Noble's bookstore in New Brunswick.
Check it out at democracynow.org. And Marilyn Ralston, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Calling Home the Dead on Thursday, October 19th at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Calling Home the Dead is a fundraiser for VOZ and KBOO Community Radio that includes music, dancing, a procession of cachinas y cachinas, and delicious Dia de los Muertos pastries and horchata. The film, Calling Home the Dead, will also be screened, showing the Dia de los Muertos traditions of the towns that surround Lake Pátzcuaro in Mexico. Again, that's Calling Home the Dead on Thursday, October 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Decolonizing Our Activism Workshop, Saturday, October 28th at the Native American Youth and Family Center in Portland. The Decolonizing Our Activism Workshop welcomes all to attend this free life-changing training, which incorporates traditional Native American teachings through stories, exercises, and discussions that are even more relevant and needed today. These workshops are conducted in a respectful way that is both healing and empowering. Again, that is Decolonizing Our Activism Workshop on Saturday, October 28th, 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. at the Native American Youth and Family Center, 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard, Portland, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening. It is a couple minutes past 5, and KBOO Evening News is coming up next. This program has been made possible by KBOO members and support from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News this Saturday morning from 11 to 12 will be the grand opening of Leuvitt View Park.
Environmental Protection Agency head Ryan Zink said he would be getting rid of scientists on EPA's advisory boards who receive federal grants, as he believes it would compromise their work.
And Google unveiled artificial intelligence technology that excels at the ability to learn and to create its own knowledge.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 18th, 2017. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is thinking about power and about chickens.
Humans must have evolved from chickens, since we always have pecking orders, power over someone else, the power of parents, teachers, bosses, film producers, presidents. We move from our hometowns in hopes of a better spot in a different order. Men exert their power over women. Euro settlers deem natives inferior savages. My higher power is better than your higher power, so you must adopt my religion. Modern world power is based on oil, so the big guns won't give it up, dooming our planet and everyone. We got to fight the powers that be. More alternative power, renewable power, community power, open hands, not fists, give, don't take. If we were all the same, the human race would have died out eons ago. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Portland doesn't need more high-rise condos, but it does need, among other things, more parks. This Saturday morning from 11 to 2 will be the grand opening of Lewitt View Park next to Shaver Elementary School at Northeast 127th and Fremont, a part of the city lacking in parks. Lewitt is the Upper Cowlitz tribe's name for Mount St. Helens, which, on clear days, can be seen from the park. The 16-acre park includes playground equipment, a skate park, public ping pong tables, sports fields, a community garden, and interactive water features. Planning for this park, which was originally called Beach Park, began in 2008.
Let's pretend there's an earthquake tomorrow, just in case. At 10:19 a.m. tomorrow on the 19th of October, it's the Great Shakeout, an event which began in California in 2008 and is now global with over 55 million participants every year. At that very moment, many of the 500,000 Oregonians expected to participate will get under desks or other strong furniture for a minute and then exit to safe, prearranged gathering places to await the all-clear signal to go back inside. Participants are encouraged to take a photo when they're ducking and to share it on their personal media networks with the hashtag GreatShakeout. Most state and local government offices and several businesses will take part in the drill. Customers in the offices at the time are not asked to duck, but are taken out of the office with the employees.
Is Washington finally doing something constructive about healthcare reform? A new bipartisan agreement gives a two-year extension of federal payments to health insurers, which Trump has halted last week. Industry analysts have also said that without these payments, premiums would rise sharply and some insurers would leave unprofitable markets. Agreement authors Washington Senator Patty Murray and Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander have also received encouragement from President Trump on this issue, who said, quote, "It is a short-term solution so we don't have this very dangerous little period. Still, the future of this bill and further healthcare reform remains uncertain. Because of this uncertainty, Oregon insurers will still raise rates 7.1% on some plans for next year."
The American Civil Liberties Union won a lawsuit for an undocumented immigrant teenager's right to have an abortion. She was under the custody of the United States government at a Texas shelter, legally obliging them to provide reproductive rights. Though the shelter provided consent for the Jane Doe client to have the abortion, they restricted access to have the procedure. Jane Doe claimed she attended religiously affiliated counseling to continue the pregnancy and had a sonogram both against her will. Brigitte Amiri, attorney for the ACLU, said, quote, "This case isn't the only one. Nationally, the federal government is obstructing young immigrant women's rights to an abortion. It's blatantly unconstitutional, not to mention unconscionable."
And now for a daily compilation report from the Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Wednesday, October the 18th, 2017. I'm Mike Clifford. In focus on today's rundown, President Trump's reported comments to a grieving military widow raising some eyebrows. We've got a breakdown of the impact of Trump care in states like Colorado, and a look back 50 years at Dow Chemical protests that turned violent in Wisconsin. Now, our top story, The Hill reporting. Representative Frederica Wilson told multiple news outlets Tuesday she overheard President Donald Trump tell the widow of Army Sergeant LaDavid Johnson that Johnson knew what he signed up for, but when it happens, it hurts anyway. Wilson telling CNN she was in the car with Johnson's widow to meet the soldier's body in Miami when Trump made the call. Johnson was one of the four U.S. soldiers killed in the ambush in Niger. Consumer advocates warn that President Trump's decision to stop payments to health insurance companies will hit middle-class families the hardest through increased premiums. And Eric Gladys tells us it could also end up unraveling the marketplaces established by the Affordable Care Act for people who don't get insurance through their jobs.
Adam Fox with the Colorado Consumer Health Initiative believes it's part of an overall pattern to sabotage former President Barack Obama's signature legislation.
So while Trump has said he will let Obamacare fail, he is not letting it fail. He is actively creating conditions to bring about its failure. And consumers are going to be hurt because of it.
Fox explains that even without federal reimbursements, insurance companies are still required to provide cost-sharing reductions, which make access to care possible for low-income people by lowering deductibles and copays. Trump claims the move and his decision to allow policies that don't meet ACA standards will give more people affordable care at no cost to the federal government.
A bipartisan effort led by Tennessee GOP Senator Lamar Alexander and Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington State, to reinstate the cost-sharing reductions could be introduced later this week. Meantime, a case being heard by the U.S. District Court in Greensboro stands to end the practice of gerrymandering for good. More from Stephanie Carson.
The term has been a part of North Carolina's public discourse for decades, with both major political parties guilty at one point of drawing districts to benefit them. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled racial gerrymandering unconstitutional earlier this year, but the status of drawing districts based on party affiliation is still nebulous. That may change with the outcome of Common Cause versus Rucho, explains Brian Warner of the group Common Cause.
Partisan gerrymandering is kind of the last refuge of partisan politicians who are looking to manipulate our voting maps. If we can strike down partisan gerrymandering alongside striking down racial gerrymandering, this could be a huge win for voters in North Carolina and around the nation.
Warner adds the U.S. Supreme Court is considering a similar challenge in a case from Wisconsin. There's a current bill in the state assembly that would take redistricting power out of the hands of partisan lawmakers by giving it to an independent body.
People who want New Mexico to have its own clean energy standard are making their case today to the state's Public Regulation Commission. Ross Brown reports supporters say it would help the state determine its role in addressing climate change.
The New Mexico Attorney General's Office and consumer advocates have petitioned the commission to consider the standard in order to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from power plants in the state by 4% a year through 2040. Shannon Hughes with the group Climate Guardians says while the Trump administration continues to talk about bringing back coal, New Mexico is going in the opposite direction.
The reality is that American utilities and consumers are moving on from this dirty, expensive fuel. Ultimately, I think, you know, as we've seen, the market's going to speak for itself.
The Public Regulation Commissioners will decide whether to begin a rulemaking process that includes gathering comments, hosting technical workshops, and public meetings in order to move forward. I'm Roz Brown.
The Public Service Company of New Mexico has already invested almost $270 million in 15 solar generation facilities. And finally, Tim Morrissey tells us it was 50 years ago today, Wisconsin made national headlines when a student sit-in against a Dow chemical company became violent. Students were protesting the company's recruiting presence on campuses because Dow was the manufacturer of napalm, a highly flammable gel used in the Vietnam War.
The sit-in turned violent when police in riot gear threw tear gas and started to remove students forcibly with billy clubs. The event garnered national TV coverage as it was the first time an anti-war demonstration on a major U.S. campus turned violent. UW Communications has just released a multimedia presentation recalling the day. Meredith McGlone's media team at UW-Madison created the piece, which she says represents the differing points of view regarding the Dow protests.
If you're going to approach a topic that certainly was very controversial 50 years ago, remains somewhat controversial today, that we really needed to do as good a job as we could portraying a broad diversity of viewpoints.
The presentation, called A Turning Point, is online at 1967.wisc.edu.
Nearly 50 students were hospitalized that day, including protesters, supporters, and some bystanders. That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, a daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton in for Antonia Gonzalez. A leadership dispute within the Northern Cheyenne tribe remains unresolved after the Bureau of Indian Affairs' decision this week to back the tribal council. Earlier this month, the council voted 9-1 to remove Jace Kilsback as president, but he has refused to step away, claiming that the council held the removal hearing illegally. The Billings Gazette reports a BIA superintendent sent a letter this week officially recognizing the vote after the council sent paperwork showing they had followed their constitution. The council has declined to publicly provide specific accusations against Kilsback, but indicated an official can be removed, quote, for failing to perform their assigned duties. Kilsback told KTVQ TV Tuesday that he'd begun a fraud investigation that revealed a payroll advance scheme by the tribe's treasurer. In a statement, the council said Vice President Conrad Fisher will serve as interim president until they hold a special election. Kilsback's attorney asked the BIA to withdraw its letter and said Kilsback still plans to challenge the council's vote in tribal court. A tribal judge approved a temporary restraining order against the former chairman of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, who's now in custody on assault charges. KFYR-TV reports Wayne Kaplan was arrested Monday after a series of alleged confrontations with tribal council members, including breaking into a tribal office and trying to take back his resignation and form his own government. The tribe initially called for Kaplan's resignation after they said he was under federal investigation for allegedly misusing tribal funds for personal use. Earlier this month, Kaplan accused two tribal council members of colluding against him. One of those, Roman Marcellet, is now serving as acting chairman. Members of the Narragansett Indian tribe claim their leaders illegally agreed to sell the tribe's water to the developer of a proposed natural gas power plant. As Rhode Island Public Radio's environmental reporter Avery Brookins reports, one of the tribe's elected officials organized a march Saturday to protest the water deal.
What do we say? No! What do we say? No!
About 30 tribal members and power plant opponents marched down Broad Street in Providence to the State House downtown. Power plant developer Invenergy recently announced the tribe as the backup water supplier to cool its proposed plant. But members claim the water deal was made without a vote from the tribal body, which violates the tribe's constitution. Tribal Councilman Randy Noka spoke at the State House.
We don't support something that harms the environment such as that power plant will do. The fracking of the natural resources, the water that it's going to need to operate, the pollutions and pollutants that it's going to put in the air.
In a press release, Invenergy indicated it made a long-term agreement with the tribe and quoted medicine man John Brown, saying the deal would provide much-needed financial support for the tribe. But it's unclear who Invenergy made the agreement with. Tribal officials did not immediately return requests for comment. Tribal elder and march organizer Darlene Monroe says the next step is to file a court order that would put a stop to the water agreement. For National Native News, I'm Avery Brookins.
Two men who partnered with Nebraska and Oklahoma tribes to run payday loan businesses face lengthy prison sentences for violating laws against charging excessive interest. A federal court convicted businessman Scott Tucker and his attorney Timothy Muir, saying the partnerships with the tribes were based on a lie aimed at sidestepping laws designed to protect consumers from predatory, deceptive loan practices. Tucker had agreements with the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, the Modoc Tribe of Oklahoma, and the Santee Sioux Nation of Nebraska. Tucker and Muir maintained the lending businesses were tribally owned, and therefore their practices were protected by sovereign immunity. The judge agreed with prosecutors who said the tribes had little to do with the loan businesses, and the agreements were a sham to shield the companies from state and federal laws. With National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was the day that Paul Robeson received the Spingarn Medal from the NAACP. The award was given annually to the African-American with the highest achievement. Robeson certainly fit that criteria. He was born in Princeton, New Jersey. He attended Rutgers University, where he was an athletic standout and valedictorian. He earned his law degree from Columbia. He was a successful singer, as well as stage and film actor. He was also an internationally recognized star, with singing engagements all around the world. Robeson strongly supported labor and working people. He was also an outspoken critic of U.S. colonialism. His stand for social justice made him a target of Senator Joe McCarthy during the hysteria of the Cold War Red Scare. Because of his alleged communist ties, in 1950, Robeson's passport was revoked. It took him 8 years to get it reissued. During that time, he could not travel abroad to perform. The International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers invited Robeson to sing at their Canadian convention in 1952. Since he could not travel, he sang over the telephone. The union then organized a concert on the Washington State-Canadian border. Standing on a flatbed truck parked on the U.S. side of the border, Robeson gave a 45-minute performance to a crowd of 40,000 people. He started the concert by saying, quote, "I stand here today under great stress because I dare, as do you, all of you, to fight for peace and for a decent life for all men, women, and children." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free?
Now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The ongoing humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico remains life-threatening as Americans on the island continue to struggle to get medical care and critical supplies. National Nurses United RN Kathy Kennedy is volunteering in Puerto Rico with the union's RN Emergency Response Network.
We have a health care crisis right now, right here in Puerto Rico. We have been going out, going into communities where all they ask for is water and food. I mean, you have to make a decision as to, okay, who's going to get the food today or the water? We shouldn't have to do that. The United States is the richest nation in the world. Puerto Rico is part of the United States.
SEIU union doctor Dr. Jen Packard says what's unfolding is a man-made crisis, a failure to get enough help in quick enough.
I'm hearing a lot of word from my colleagues in the field that they're seeing people who haven't eaten for 3 days. A lot of them are old people who didn't want to leave, didn't want to evacuate. They're very proud people. They don't ask for handouts. They will always say, go check on my neighbor. I'm worried about my neighbor. And we would ask, how are you doing? Do you have food? Do you have water? And when we ask very specific questions, we find out that their next food shipment might not be coming in until a week later. There was another team that saw an elderly person who was being abused by their caretakers. And when the team went to check on her, she had already written a suicide note.
Florida is doing a state constitution revision, and SEIU wants to make sure that the top priorities of working people are included in any constitutional changes. Proposed constitutional amendments will be on the Florida ballot in 2018. Monica Russo, president of SEIU Florida, says among top worker priorities for constitutional changes are a higher minimum wage, housing affordability, real affordable health care, and a better justice system. SEIU says workers in Florida are burdened by housing costs, continuing cuts to public education, disappearing access to quality health care, vast income inequality, and antiquated laws that criminalize poverty. SEIU says these are all structural issues that can be addressed by pro-worker state constitutional changes. Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis says she suffered a slight stroke last week as she recovers from brain cancer. In a written statement, Lewis says the stroke was so minor that doctors could barely see it on her initial examination. She says she is feeling pretty good. She called the stroke a minor setback in her recovery from brain cancer and will be back on her feet soon. And Lewis says once she's back to 100% health, she will be giving hell to the usual suspects in her work for the union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the Boo. At 6, it's What's Life Without Laughter, followed at 6:30 by Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, it's Combined Culture Radio. Tonight's weather will be stormy, with up to half an inch of rain, 15 to 20 mile per hour winds gusting up to 32, and low temperature of 55. Today in history, in 1867, the U.S. took possession of Alaska, having purchased the territory from Russia, who stole it from its indigenous residents for less than 2 cents an acre. The quote of the day is from baseball great Reggie Jackson, who 40 years ago today hit 3 home runs on 3 consecutive pitches from 3 different pitchers. "I am not merely a baseball player, I am a black man who has done what he wants, gotten what he wanted, and will continue to get it."
With all its proposed tax cuts to corporations and the wealthy, the Trump administration is looking for new sources of revenue, including selling oil leases to part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, commonly known as ANWR. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke has also prioritized drilling in ANWR, citing possible revenues to federal coffers totaling $1.8 billion over the next decade. Back in 1980, President Carter signed a bill that created the 19.6 million-acre refuge. That bill directed that 1.5 million acres of coastland in the refuge could be surveyed for possible oil and gas, but left the decision on whether to allow drilling up to Congress. The Trump administration plans to make the rule to open that area to drilling as part of a special budget reconciliation process, which would require just 51 votes in the Senate. Since the last resource assessment in the area was done nearly 20 years ago, it is uncertain how much oil and resulting revenue could come from drilling. And with oil prices currently low at around $40 a barrel, it is unknown if any companies would want to take on the risks that come with working in the Arctic.
Speaking to the Heritage Foundation last night, Environmental Protection Agency head Scott Pruitt said he would be getting rid of scientists on EPA's advisory boards who received federal grants that it would, quote, compromise their work. In other words, only those funded by industry or the wealthy would be eligible as advisors. Over the last couple months, the EPA has been soliciting candidates for its advisory board and informing scientists currently advising the EPA that their contracts will not be renewed. The agency published a list of 132 possible candidates for board positions, including numerous people who have questioned mainstream research about the causes and severity of climate change.
And now it's time for a 90-second climate change report from Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A group of self-described vintage-age women are fighting to save the planet, and they're not taking any guff. Make room for 100 Grannies.
100 Grannies is an organization of older women, not necessarily biological grandmothers, but women who care about future generations.
That's Ann Christensen, co-founder of the Iowa-based group whose mission is to educate, advocate, and agitate for the transition to clean energy.
We work to mitigate climate change by crusading to keep fossil fuels in the ground.
Members' husbands are lovingly called grumpies, but they're not allowed to join the group.
We felt that this is an opportunity for all kinds of women who can cooperate together. We work together, I think, better than we might with men.
The group lobbies lawmakers and hosts regular public talks and film screenings about climate change. The women also protest the development of new fossil fuel pipelines. Christensen has been arrested twice during these protests, but she remains committed to the cause.
We've got to do this for our kids and grandkids and their kids.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now it's time for the Green News Report, a newscast on environmental issues.
You can really feel the sheer power of Ophelia.
Record-breaking hurricane batters Ireland. Yes, Ireland.
A turning point as firefighters make significant progress.
Gaining ground against deadliest wildfires in California history. Desperate Puerto Ricans obtaining water from toxic Superfund sites. Plus,
today, tragedy knows no boundaries.
Search for a missing worker suspended after an oil rig explodes in Louisiana.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
And I left Florida, and I left Louisiana, and I went to Puerto Rico, and I met with the president of the Virgin Islands.
Alexa, who is the president of the Virgin Islands?
The U.S. Virgin Islands president is Donald Trump.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, Donald Trump held a 40-minute press conference in the Rose Garden on Monday, and with all of the assembled media there and all of the hurricanes we've had in the recent weeks and all of the fires, not one of those reporters could manage to ask Donald Trump about climate change and pulling out of the Paris Agreement. As much as Donald Trump seems to be failing, our national media continues to be failing all of us.
Yes, they are, but we won't. Fueled by an unusually warm Atlantic Ocean, Hurricane Ophelia reached Category 3 status on Saturday, breaking the record for the farthest east a major Atlantic hurricane has ever existed, another record storm in a record Atlantic storm season. Ophelia's remnants smashed into Ireland on Monday.
Ireland.
As of airtime, killing at least three people, according to Ireland's national police. A recent study predicted that the warming Atlantic Ocean is putting Europe at risk for even more hurricanes. In Northern California, state fire officials say more than 11,000 firefighters from across the U.S., Canada, and Australia are gaining ground against catastrophic heat and wind-driven wildfires in the state's wine country. It's been the deadliest week of wildfires in California state history. As of airtime, the fires have killed at least 41 people. Nearly 100 people are still listed as missing. More than 5,700 buildings destroyed. Damages in Sonoma County alone are estimated to cost more than $3 billion. Smoke from the fires has generated the worst air quality in the Bay Area's history. It's estimated the fires have already released air pollution equivalent to that released by all of the state's cars in an entire year. Fighting the record western wildfire season of 2017 has cost the federal government nearly $3 billion and has already surpassed the previous record set for firefighting in 2015. And this year's fire season is not over yet. In Portugal and Spain, officials over the weekend reported at least 34 people died in hundreds of wildfires that were whipped up by wind gusts from passing Hurricane Ophelia. And in Brazil, wildfires in the Amazon rainforest are nearing a new annual record as Brazil's dry seasons become even drier. Climate scientists warn that global warming is accelerating the speed of wildfires in California and elsewhere. According to UCLA climate scientist Daniel Swain in an interview with Climate Progress, quote, increasing temperature plays a significant role in making these fires more explosive and covering ground more quickly.
And yet, with all of that, not one single question about climate to the President of the United States in a 40-minute press conference.
In Puerto Rico, nearly a month after Hurricane Maria, 30% of Puerto Rico still lacks potable drinking water. The Washington Post reports that desperate residents have been forced to obtain drinking water from wells at toxic Superfund sites. Food shortages have been reported, but at the White House on Monday, President Trump again suggested that residents are to blame for that as well.
We have massive amounts of food, but they have to distribute the food, and they have to do this. They have to distribute the food to the people of the island. So what we've done is we now actually have military distributing food, something that really they shouldn't have to be doing.
So once again, everyone else but Donald Trump is to blame. Got it.
In Louisiana, unfortunately, Jefferson Parish officials have suspended the search for a missing rig worker after an explosion and fire that engulfed an oil and natural gas storage platform located in Lake Pontchartrain on Sunday. In addition to the missing worker, seven others were injured, three critically. The cause is under investigation, and the state believes no oil was released. But in a separate incident, an oil pipeline rupture off the coast of Louisiana on Friday spilled an estimated 350,000 gallons. Of crude oil. Finally, some good news.
Took you long enough.
The Chinese government announced it has canceled 150 proposed new coal plants, equal to the combined generating capacity of both Germany and Japan. And great news for breathers in Texas. Electric utility Luminant has announced it is closing three unprofitable coal plants in the state earlier than planned because of cheap natural gas and the glut of renewable energy.
Wow, Donald Trump's Barack Obama's war on coal is really hurting these people. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Google has unveiled an artificial intelligence technology that excels at the ability to learn and to create its own knowledge. The program, AlphaGo Zero, became a master of the Chinese board game Go within 3 days after only being told the basic rules. The program was developed by Google's artificial intelligence group, Deep Six. An older version of AlphaGo defeated grandmaster of the game Lee Sedol, and AlphaGo defeated that program with a ratio of 100 to 1. AlphaGo is only capable of learning what can be mastered in a computer simulation and not what requires real-life applications. Deep Six is working towards AlphaGo Zero discovering how proteins fold as a next step towards general-purpose artificial intelligence.
The provincial parliament of Quebec has passed a controversial law making it difficult for Muslim women to wear the veil as they go about their daily lives. The law, known as Bill 62, passed this morning. It applies to municipal employees, which in Canada includes doctors, nurses, teachers, and daycare workers, according to Al Jazeera. It denies the right to public services to women who are wearing the veil. The government, led by the Liberal Party, which backed the bill, defended it as the state religious neutrality measure that singles nobody out. Canadian Muslim advocacy groups, however, say that the bill clearly targets Muslim women. The government has yet to provide guidelines to state employees on how to behave when approached for services by women wearing the veil, and some say the rule will be impossible to implement, especially for basic services like bus transit. The mayor of Montreal balked at the exact scenario, saying, quote, "If the driver says you can come in, will we have citizens who take the law into their own hands?" Haroun Bouazi, co-president of the advocacy group Amal Quebec, said that the bill's passage marks a sad day for Canada, proving that the government can strip fundamental rights from citizens with, quote, "no real or urgent reason."
The city of Raqqa in eastern Syria is little more than depopulated ruins after a four-month battle to retake the city from the Islamic State. Once a provincial capital of a few hundred thousand people along the Euphrates River, Raqqa was transformed in the summer of 2014 into the de facto capital of a brutal fundamentalist state. After the fall of Mosul this summer, Raqqa was the only remaining urban center of Islamic State power. It was recaptured by the Kurdish-dominated and U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, who claim full control of the broken city, according to the BBC. The United Nations announced today that it's ready to enter Raqqa and began the process of lending aid and relocation assistance to more than 300,000 refugees in squalid camps on the outskirts of the city. Other aid agencies, such as the World Food Program, have called the end of IS in Raqqa a, quote, "game changer." For years, the group was openly hostile and violent towards aid organizations, and the humanitarian situation in the camps is nearing a breaking point with little to no food or water or medicine available. Islamic State remains in control of territory to the southeast of the city in Deir al-Zor province. Both the SDF and U.S. forces and the Syrian government, backed by Russian air power, have launched separate campaigns to retake that province.
Over 15,000 refugees are stranded at the Bangladesh border, coming in from the sovereign state of Myanmar since Saturday night. Most of the refugees are Rohingya, a demographic with restricted citizen rights compared to the rest of Myanmar, fleeing from government persecution in the form of violence and death. The United Nations Refugee Agency is monitoring the migration and providing humanitarian services. Bangladesh Red Crescent and Action Against Hunger are feeding the refugees as they wander and squat at and around the border. An estimated 582,000 refugees have arrived in Bangladesh since the violence erupted in Myanmar's northern Rakhine state in August.
October 14th marked the 7th anniversary of Rwandan political prisoner Victoire Ingabire's arrest in Rwanda. Her supporters around the world commemorate it as Ingabire Day. Ingabire challenged the lies about the Rwandan genocide that have been used to justify extreme repression in Rwanda and horrific violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ann Garrison of Pacific Radio has this report.
7 years ago today, Victoire Ingabire was arrested in Rwanda's capital, Kigali, after attempting to run for president against the country's military dictator, President Paul Kagame. The Brussels-based International Women's Network for Democracy and Peace called today Ingabire Day, a day of solidarity with Victoire Ingabire and all Rwandan political prisoners. In a video produced to mark the day, they say that she was arrested for saying this.
It is essential that all Rwandans, regardless of their ethnic group, understand that it is time to unite, to share mutual compassion in order for us to build a sustainable peace in our country. That is the reason why I am back in Rwanda. It is in order that we should all walk together on the path of unity and reconciliation, so that we can work together to find the solution, to ensure that injustice never prevails again, and finally all Rwandans can live freely in our country.
I asked Claude Gatebuke, Rwandan genocide survivor and founder of the African Great Lakes Action Network, to explain Victoire Ingabire's message.
Her message was, let's tell the truth about what happened. Let's tell the truth about the massacres and the atrocities committed against the Tutsis. Let's tell the truth about the massacres and atrocities committed against the Hutus. And that implicated the government of Rwanda, led by Paul Kagame, especially his ruling party and military, the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, because they were implicated in the massacres of Hutus and Tutsis, actually, but mostly Hutus.
President Paul Kagame, his party, and his international supporters, including Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, and Reverend Rick Warren, claim that ethnic conflict has been overcome in Rwanda, that Hutu and Tutsi have reconciled. So why did Victoire call for reconciliation?
That is simply not true. The ethnic cleansing that took place against the Hutus by the RPF, and also the ethnic cleansing that took place against the Tutsis by the extremist Hutus. There are people who are hurt on both sides, who have not seen justice, who are still harboring fears, who are still hurt, who still carry trauma. And it's simply not true to state that it's over and that the ethnic conflict has ended. And that is exactly why Victoire called for reconciliation and healing, because everyone will at least know the truth. Everyone will at least have some closure about what happened to their family.
And isn't there also an issue of Hutu people having equality in Rwanda?
There is a big issue with that. And let me just highlight one major area. There is a policy in Rwanda called Ndumunyarwanda, which basically requires every Hutu to apologize to the Tutsis for the genocide of 1994. This is including children who were not born at the time when the genocide took place. That's also including Hutu children who were way too young, under 10 years old, or even younger, to apologize for crimes committed by other Hutus, as if a crime is universal to the ethnic group.
And isn't wealth and power concentrated in the hands of a Tutsi elite?
Yes, there's actually a small group of Tutsis who were mostly military men who came from Uganda, the country where the RPF invaded from, who run the country. And wealth and power is concentrated among that group.
And that was Claude Gatebuke, Rwandan genocide survivor and founder of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Victoire Ingabire's appeal of her conviction and 15-year sentence is before the African Court of Human and People's Rights, which could rule any day. The United States is the top bilateral donor to Rwanda, and Rwanda is its long-standing military partner and proxy on the African continent. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA and Afrobeat Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Sam Bowman. The producer is myself, Kyle Carrezzi. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell will bring you the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fogering speaks with investigative reporter Robert Perry about the mainstream media's exaggeration of Russiagate. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, on Between the Covers, Dan Johnson talks with author Craig Johnson about the latest book in his Longmire series, the basis for the Netflix show Longmire. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate right now to become a member.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Good afternoon. This is Mike Crenshaw, and it is once again time for News from the Boo, our weekly news segment brought to you by station co-managers Delphine Crescenzo and myself. We air every Wednesday on 90.7 FM KBOO.Portland, KBOO Community Radio, from 5:45 to 6 p.m. That's right, Wednesday afternoons. And we like to talk to you about things happening in the KBOO community of or related to the KBOO community. Today I have two special guests. I have Jonathan and Olivia from Woodlawn Mike. I just recently met them, and they've got an incredible program running in northeast Portland, and I invited them down to talk about it. So let's start with you, Olivia. Tell us about who you are, where you're from, and what Woodlawn Mike is.
Yeah, my name is Olivia. I'm originally from Seattle and just moved to Portland about 3 months ago because my partner is teaching at Kairos PDX. That could be a whole nother radio segment, but we'll stick to the point here. The Woodlawn Mike is running out of the former United Methodist Church building on 1425 in Deakin, and that church officially closed not too long ago. And the United Methodist Church as an institution knows that churches with pews are no longer relevant really to the 21st century and millennials and folks who are interested in spirituality. So we're creating a community hub that's going to host arts, events, entrepreneurship, healing, really a diversity of things that is centered around people of color, because we know that the Woodlawn community was a historically Black community, and so we want to carve out space for people of color to have in Woodlawn.
So that's, again, you said 1425?
Yep.
Northeast Deakin?
Yes, sir.
Okay, right off of